they left behind. Garments that were once worn on a living, breathing person going about her daily business, garments that were soiled and washed and mended and altered, garments that expressed her aspirations and reflected her condition. As curator of history, you know, we did a little research on her and we asked her colleagues and they all said she was a star. So we are in for a treat to hear from Erica about clothing in the history of Illinois. Thank you so much for joining us as a speaker. We so look forward to your presentation.
Well, thank you. That's very kind and generous, and I hope I live up to expectations. One thing I have going for me is that I'm passionate about what I'm talking about. So I kind of dug deep, and I hope you wind up learning something and enjoying it too. I'm going to try to share my screen now, and this is my first time giving a Zoom lecture. So we'll see how this goes. And let's see.
They can't even see me right now. I think there were 38 of them.
Slideshow. From beginning. And okay. Does everyone see the first slide that says, welcome to the Marvin and Thomas Lee Likes lecture? I guess, oh, sorry, you're probably all muted. I should
have mentioned that. Yes, we can see it. We can see it.
Okay. Okay, so in the interest of not having, you know, cats meowing in the background and all that, I think most everyone's going to be muted, and I will be taking questions over webinar chat. So the way this is going to go is I'm going to kind of go through my lecture and then save all your questions, or you can ask them via chat as they occur to you, or save them for the end. And then at the end of the presentation, I'll go and read through and see what questions we have and try to address them. So if that works for everyone, okay, we will get underway. So, well, there we go. So the topic is Fashioning Illinois, 1820 to 1900. And this is an exhibition which was going to open on March 21st, 2020 at the Illinois State Museum. Now we got sent home on March 13th, 2020. So we were a week out for opening, and then the pandemic kind of swept everything away, which, you know, we've had a rough 3 months. The exhibit was supposed to run through January 10th of next year. Now that has been amended to, we hope to open soon. And in fact, I haven't been cleared to tell you when we will reopen, but a date has been set. So the museum is going to reopen and this exhibition will be up when we open our doors. And then it will last, the run will be extended. So this is your pre-advertisement here. I hope that when the museum opens up, you will come out and see some of these dresses in person. So the exhibition, in a nutshell, is it's a lot of pretty dresses from the 19th century, but we're also hoping to dig a little deeper than just eye candy and go kind of into what it took to make and clean and care for garments, kind of the entire experience of wearing them. So these are the components that are in the exhibition. There's the changes in fashion over time. There's the types of garments worn for different occasions. There's undergarments, making cloth, making clothing, mending clothing, washing clothing, recycling clothing. And then there was going to be an interactive room, but the interactive room is a casualty of the pandemic, and we had to rearrange the show and pull out anything that anyone could touch and potentially leave germs on and replace it with more things to look at. So it ended up working out, but we were kind of sad to see we had some things where kids could dress mannequins and those have gone by the wayside. But for this talk tonight, I'm going to be talking to you about making clothing and the types of garments worn for different occasions. And it will be in that order. And I'm sorry, I see someone has raised their hand. And I don't know what that means.
A question.
Is it a question?
I think you should probably just go go finish your talk. We really haven't worked that out.
Okay, I'm going to do that then. In the interest of beta testing this new Zoom talk format for myself. So we're going to dive in with making clothing and what that was like in the 19th century. And the most important thing to realize about clothing of the 19th century is that it was made for somebody, not for just anybody, which is to say, every single garment that everybody wore up until the very end of the century was handmade or machine made, but made to fit a specific body. So your dress fit you, you know, whatever the particular shape of your torso was, that's what kind of clothes you wore. There wasn't a lot of trading clothes without some alterations going on. And then I'm going to invite you to think about what that meant, just as the experience of making and wearing and owning clothes. If you take a minute to look down at what you're wearing right now, whatever it is, imagine if every single stitch that went into your underwear, your pants, your top, your whatever, every single stitch you're wearing was one that you did personally. Think of the investment in your clothing that you would have if it was all constructed by hand. Think how much it would reflect you having chosen, you know, the fabric, the style, the stitchery. It's an expression of craftsmanship. And think how that might make you feel about clothing. And it might be a complicated relationship. You know, you might have pride of craftsmanship, pride in your skills and being able to clothe yourself and your children and your family. It might also be drudgery, because if you were a 19th century woman, you would have a needle put into your hands at about age 4 years old, and you could confidently expect to keep sewing the entire rest of your life. You would be making clothes, you would be mending clothes. This would be an unending task. So just like there are some, you know, people today who enjoy cooking and some people think it's a, you know, chore they have to get through every day, certainly probably the same thoughts applied to sewing and making clothing in the 19th century. Oops, going the wrong way here. So when it came to making clothing, women had two basic choices. They could either make their garments by hand, or they could hire a dressmaker to make garments for them. And actually, most women did probably a combination of the two. But the dresses we're showing you as an example, the one on the left, the striped dress, this is a homespun garment that was made by a woman in Southern Illinois around the year 1860. She actually wove that fabric herself. It's a Lindsay-Woolsey blend, which seems to imply linen and wool. Actually, by that time, it was linen and cotton blended together. So she wove the fabric, she dyed it herself, she cut the cloth, she made this dress entirely by hand. And when, I hope you go to see it in real life, you'll notice that it's kind of clumsily constructed. The waist is a little bit off, the buttons aren't spaced quite evenly. You can tell that she wasn't a professional seamstress, but she was a woman who was economizing in her household. She was using the skills that she had to keep herself clothed. The dress on the right was made by a seamstress named Miss Graham in Lincoln, Illinois, and unfortunately, we don't know Miss Graham's first name, but this was a dress that was made for a woman named Bridget Fogarty's wedding in 1876, and so she went to a local seamstress who could help her with all the details, with the precise fit of the bodice, with all the kind of intricacies of that bustle dress. So like I said earlier, all 19th century women knew how to sew. And if there were exceptions to this, there were very, very few. Sewing was considered a life skill that was expected of all women, and girls would start very, very young. By the time they were 4 or 5 years old, they would be sewing clothes for their dolls, they'd be practicing their stitches, they would be expected to help their mothers later on as they got older. It didn't matter if women were rich or poor. Rich women mended just like poor women, and this is because even if they had the means to hire servants to help with their housework, they would tend to give servants chores like cooking dinner or scrubbing the floors or the kind of hot dirty, physically exhausting work. The tasks that the employer would keep for herself were the ones that she could do sitting in a rocking chair that are a little bit cleaner and less physically taxing. So women of all economic strata, all ages, all knew how to sew. So most women typically made their own underwear. They typically made their children's clothes, and they typically made their men's shirts, their husbands and their sons and their brothers' shirts. For more complicated things, for special occasion dresses, women tended to turn to a dressmaker who had specialized skills. Now, a dressmaker was considered a skilled professional. And this is not to be confused with a seamstress, and we'll talk about seamstresses in a little bit. But a dressmaker was a skilled professional, and this was the most lucrative of any woman's job in the 19th century. Dressmakers typically went from home to home and sewed in their clients' homes. They were afforded the dignity of being addressed by Miss or Mrs. rather than by first names, as most domestic servants were. Women who were especially successful started their own shops. And so for a woman who was talented with a needle, this was an avenue to economic independence and sometimes to freedom. It didn't cost very much to start up a dressmaking business. And so this is a path to self-sufficiency for a lot of immigrant women, African-American women, native-born working class women, women who otherwise might be in domestic service or in factory work. If they were good sewers, they could really get a leg up by becoming dressmakers. So we're going to dive into the ready-made clothing industry because I think this is a fascinating aspect of the 19th century. And I'm going to start off by telling you that the cotton economy led directly to the rise of the ready-made clothing industry in the 19th century. And to connect from A to B, I'm going to back up and start talking about the cotton economy and its impact on the 19th century. And I would say that it started in 1793 with Eli Whitney's cotton gin, which was an invention that would help quickly clean the seeds out of cotton. And just like Alfred Nobel might not have realized when he created dynamite for miners that his product would be used to create chaos and destruction in the world, probably Eli Whitney had no idea what he was unleashing on the world when he created a simple farming implement to clean seeds out of cotton. But it did unleash repercussions that were felt worldwide. So cotton was being grown in America in the 18th century prior to the cotton gin, but the problem was it was not a lucrative crop because picking the seeds out was so labor intensive. It would take days and days and days just to pick the seeds out, and so cotton couldn't be harvested and cleaned in any quantity to make it profitable. With the invention of the cotton gin, they could clean as much cotton in one day as it would take one person to clean by hand in a year. And so what that means is all of a sudden, cotton becomes profitable. And there are British textile mills that are just dying for cotton. They're ready to buy. And so it becomes quickly apparent that there's money to be made in cotton. So the state of the United States, as it is in the first half of the 19th century, you have older slaveholding states like Virginia and Maryland that used to grow tobacco. Well, by the early 19th century, the soil has been worn out for tobacco, and these farmers are shifting their production to things like wheat and livestock that require less slave labor. At the same time, now we discover that cotton is this profitable crop, and cotton growing regions are in Georgia, they're in Mississippi, they are in Alabama. And what this means is one of the things that happens is the Indian Removal Act of 1830. It is no coincidence that the lands of the United States from which Native Americans are being evicted and pushed west happen to be some of the best cotton growing lands in the United States. So the Native Americans are removed from this territory, And there's something of a gold rush. There are men from all over the United States. They're coming from the former, the old slaveholding states of the Middle Atlantic. They're coming from the North. They're coming from all over to get in on the cotton boom. The basis of the cotton economy is the enforced labor of African Americans. Without enslaved people doing the labor to grow cotton, there is no profit. And so what ends up happening is that you have what's essentially been called a second middle passage of enslaved people who are being sold from Virginia, from Maryland, from North Carolina, where the nature of agriculture has changed. They're being sold down south to Georgia, to Alabama, to Mississippi, Arkansas, and Texas. And I think this is important to note in the context of the McWhirter family. The McWhirters are in Kentucky, and Kentucky is not a big cotton growing state. And at the same time that Gerald McWhirter is hiring himself out for wages and saving up money to purchase emancipation, this is at the very time when enslaved people from that area are in real danger of being sold south to cotton plantations. So we have to assume that Mr. Gerald McWhirter or Frank McWhirter? I'm sorry. Frank McWhirter knew exactly what he was doing when he decided to work to purchase his own emancipation, because he wanted to ensure that his family was safe. I said Gerald. I'm sorry. I've got Gerald McWhirter on the brain since he gave me such a nice introduction.
Don't worry about it. I feel very close to my great-great-grandfather.
You're channeling his spirit here tonight. So just to put this in context, and then the cotton economy controlled the destiny of enslaved people. There was this massive forced migration south. There was this great boom in slavery. The entire American economy rested on the back of the cotton economy. And we might think this was a Southern thing. They were Southern plantations. It was, you know, the peculiar institution of the South. The entire United States was wrapped in on it. Sure, the cotton was being grown on Southern plantations, but then it was being sent to New England textile mills, which were profiting from it. The plantations were being financed by Northern bankers. The cotton bales were being sent to English mills on Northern ships. And then American consumers throughout the entire country were buying this cheap available cotton that was the result of this plantation economy. So really the entire country was entangled in it. So this is the background for how we've got the rise of King Cotton, and then a secondary corollary of exploited labor to come from the cotton economy comes with the rise of the mass-produced garment industry. So what you have is lots of cotton being grown, and you have cotton mills in New England, and you've got protective tariffs that are encouraging planters to send their cotton to New England mills rather than across the ocean. And so these mills are cranking out yards and yards and yards and yards of cotton fabric. But cotton fabric isn't super useful. There's only so many yards of cotton that people can buy. In order to continue to make this a profitable product, the cotton fabric had to be transformed into something useful. And that thing turned out to be clothing. And the bottleneck in clothing was that clothing was very labor-intensive to sew. You could have all these yards of cotton fabric, but to sew a shirt took 14 hours by hand. So there needed to be a way to speed up the production to create more product, essentially, to turn clothing into a consumer commodity that could be sold for profit. So in the 1820s, first you see a step towards the mass production of clothing with the kind of destigmatization of mass-produced clothing. In the 18th century, mass-produced clothing was available. Generally, it was made in England, but like sailors wore mass-produced shirts. Working class people wore mass-produced breeches. So there was a consumer class of gentlemen and middle class people who, for a long time, preferred their clothes handmade by a tailor. They thought that was a sign of refinement. Well, the Jacksonian democracy of the 1820s kind of flipped that around, and all of a sudden now it becomes socially acceptable to wear mass-produced clothing. It's the, you know, era of the common man. Ready-made shirts are no longer anything to be ashamed of. So how was clothing mass-produced in the 1820s when the sewing machine wasn't invented until the 1850s? Well, there are two answers to this. First is we have tailors standardizing their methods of measurement and drafting. So they come up with a system where you can draft patterns, and then the person doing the drafting doesn't necessarily need to be doing the cutting. He can just kind of pass on the patterns to people who can cut it out. There are also systems of measuring where, you know, one tailor doesn't need to take 26 individual measurements on a person. They can take three measurements and kind of calculate out this proportion on how a person's suit should fit. So that kind of speeds up time. But the main way that mass-produced clothing was able to happen without the aid of machines was by replacing skilled male and female workers with unskilled labor, usually that of women and children. And just to give you an example, in 1832, the tailor shops of Boston employed 300 men, 100 boys, and 1,300 women. The men were paid $2 a day, and the women and boys were paid 50 cents a day. So now we come back to our seamstresses. Remember, the dressmakers are considered a highly skilled profession that's fairly lucrative. It comes with a lot of independence and respect. Seamstresses did not have those benefits. Seamstresses were considered unskilled labor because, again, all women knew how to sew. So it wasn't considered anything special for someone to be able to do the hemming and the seaming that these factories required. To make a shirt in the 1820s, a woman sewed up to 20,000 stitches, working 12 to 14 hours a day, 6 days a week. She got paid approximately 12 and a half cents per shirt. She could make 6 to 9 shirts per week, which meant she was taking home 75 cents to $1.12 per week. So a lot of women worked on the putting out system, and this meant that she would go to a clothing manufacturer and she would pick up a pre-cut bundle of fabric. She would take it home to her house and she would sew it all together, she would line it, she would press it, and then take it back to the factory at the end of the week to collect her wages. And keep in mind that things like, you know, her candles, her firelight, her food, her time spent walking to and from the factory, this is all on her. She's eating up the overhead. This type of work was often done by widows with small children at home or wives with disabled husbands. They tended to be people who had dependents who had to be cared for at home and who needed a flexible job that could be done at home while minding children or minding people in her care. So that's the putting out system. Enter the sewing machine. So the first sewing machine was patented in 1851, and it the early versions were very heavy and expensive, so they found their way first into manufacturers and tailors' shops. It kind of gives rise to the inside system, and so in contrast to the putting out system in which women picked up the clothes, took them home to sew, and brought them back, not everyone could afford a sewing machine, and so some manufacturers purchased many, many machines, put them all under one roof, and brought women in to operate the machines and sew there. So this was the inside system. And as you can imagine, the women who took advantage of this kind of work tended to be unmarried because they could leave the house all day and didn't have, you know, children or relatives to care for or, you know, husbands at home depending on them. Sewing machine operators actually got higher wages than seamstresses because operating a sewing machine was considered more skilled than sewing by hand. It was a hardship on seamstresses nonetheless because many contractors required seamstresses to use sewing machines at home to create a more standardized product. If you didn't have a machine, you had to buy or rent one. And a lot of women who either had access to a sewing machine or had to rent them, this was direct competition for women who were still hand sewing. And so a lot of hand sewers ended up going out of business with the advent of the sewing machine. And the sewing machine also gave rise to the sweatshop. So a sweatshop is kind of like a middleman. It's not quite a factory with all the sewers under one roof. It's like subcontracting out the sewing work to a middleman who has a handful of machines. So the middleman would pick up the fabric and distribute it to his workshops. We've heard the horrors of sweatshop labor. There was a little oversight. There's a propensity for overwork, for low pay and terrible conditions. And so I end with this image of the shirtwaist blouse. And this is a blouse that came to be worn in the very late 19th century. It was modeled after a man's shirt, and it kind of became a symbol of, on one hand, the economic independence of women who are going to work in these factories. They're earning their own wages. They've got a little bit more freedom of movement and freedom of earning than perhaps they had access to before. But on the flip side, the shirt weight is also a symbol of exploitation because the garment industry only turns a profit because there are women and children working in terrible conditions for subpar wages to make it happen. And the thing is, it continues today. If we can draw parallels to the way clothing is made today, if I look down at what I'm wearing, I don't know who made my shirt or pants. I don't know what conditions they were laboring under or how much they got paid. This is how far we've come from being producers of clothing to consumers of clothing. I can only assume that the conditions that people were working in to create my clothes aren't good. And the seeds of this were started in the 1820s at the very inception of the clothing industry. Let's switch gears a little bit more. It was kind of heavy. I'm going to show you some of the dresses in the show and kind of talk about them in the context of what they meant to the 19th century women who might have worn them and owned them. So we'll dive in first with the ball gown. And I'll start with this because this is one of our most beautiful dresses. I just, from an aesthetic standpoint, I just love this dress, and it's even prettier in person. So again, I hope you go and see it. Ball gowns tended to be very fancy, very expensive, special occasion dresses. They typically had a wide neckline. They were short-sleeved. Generally, women didn't really wear short sleeves unless it was for an evening or special occasion dress. And I'm showing it to you right off the bat because the ball gown kind of skews our perception of clothing. It is way overrepresented in museum collections. There are many more ball gowns in museums than, represent how many ball gowns would have been out there and worn. And the reason for this is that the ball gown is beautiful. It's for the very reason that it was so expensive and it was so beautiful that it meant that it was more likely to be preserved. The average woman would have worn much plainer dresses on a day-to-day basis, and those dresses would have worn out. They would have been cut up for rags. They would have been made over for clothing for someone else in the family. They just wouldn't have been saved because they weren't super special. So despite the fact that you go to a museum and see ball gowns and wedding gowns, that's not actually what women generally wore. So with that segue, I'm going to dive into the two wedding dresses we have on display. And wedding dresses are the number one most overrepresented dress in museum collections, because of course it's what you're going to save. They are expensive dresses and they're very personally meaningful, and so they tend to be the types of garments that women hold on to and save and eventually donate. Again, completely not representative of a woman's everyday ensemble by any stretch of the imagination. And in the exhibit, we're showing a white wedding dress from 1854, and we're showing a blue wedding dress from 1881. And this is to illustrate the concept that wedding dresses could really be of any color in the 19th century. So Queen Victoria helped to make the white wedding dress popular when she married Prince Albert in 1840, but really this became no means a thing until the 20th century at least. It was typical for women to get married in a nice dress, which is what Bertha Hippen did when she put on that blue dress to marry William Reinhardt in 1881. It was a nice dress that could be worn for years to come, and typically women would take their nice wedding dresses and they would alter it a little bit to keep it fashionable so they could keep wearing it. White dresses tended to be very expensive and very impractical because this is something that you're only going to wear once. It's very hard to keep clean, and so a white dress was a symbol of wealth as much as it was of the bride's purity. I'm going to switch gears and go to two of my favorite dresses in the show, and these are work dresses. So this is like seeing a woman in her everyday life and attire. The 19th century had this ideal of women that they should be soft and they should be ornamental, and you know, a proper middle-class lady should sit around and read while her housework magically got done by her domestic servants. And it's just a big fat fiction. You know, women worked. Plenty of women worked for wages. They worked in factories, they worked in farms, they worked in domestic service. And those that didn't work for wages had plenty of housework in their homes. It wasn't anyone but the very, very, very wealthiest women who could expect to be entirely exempt from housework. Even middle-class women who had domestic servants would expect to work alongside those servants. So this is the type of dress that a woman might wear for work. Both of these are cotton dresses. They're durable. They could be scrubbed easily. Small prints like this tend to hide dirt and they hide stains. And with a small figured print like this, you could also patch it easily. You could turn it sometimes. You might cut the part so the worn parts are going to be hidden somewhere and the less worn parts are going to be out in front. So this is sort of just standard attire for what women would have worn every day for housework. Other dresses that are very rare in museum collections, and we happen to have two of them, are maternity dresses. So ready-made or specially made maternity dresses didn't really come into fashion until the last part of the 19th century. Before that, women either wore existing dresses that they owned, maybe nightgowns or wrappers, something loose-fitting, or they might take a dress that they had, an outdoor type of dress, and they would alter it to accommodate their pregnancy. So they might let out the seams, add panels, add drawstrings. So all maternity clothing was kind of modified for their figure. This means that it was often modified back when the childbearing years were over, or you know, when the child had been born, those same dresses were often taken in again. So not a whole lot of maternity dresses survived to us. The ones we have here, the one on the left, the white one, is a nightgown. So this would not have been worn outside her house. This was strictly for indoor wear only. This belonged to a woman named Caroline Sutherland, who gave birth to a child in 1855. The one on the left is a walking dress. So this would be appropriate for her to go out and go about her business. And this belonged to a woman named Ida Jane Pearman Stevens, who had children in 1883, 1889, and 1892. And a sad commonality for both these women is that they both died in childbirth. And I can't help but wonder if that's part of the reason that their dresses survived, is because they were perhaps packed away after the death of the owner and survived through maybe their children. And childbed fever was a killer of women. It's estimated that of every 100 births, so every 100 times someone gave birth, a woman died one out of every times giving birth. So, you know, it's something that women went into knowing that, you know, that it, there was a risk. It was an element of mortality that haunted all 19th century women. We'll flip over to children now. So these are, this is a infant dress and a toddler dress. The most important thing to know about kids' clothes in the 19th century is that people cared less to distinguish boys from girls than they did to distinguish kids from adults. So as long as kids looked like kids, they were generally in dresses. They're white, which seems at first glance like the most impractical color to put a child in. In the 19th century, it was actually the most practical color to put a child in, because white is something you can throw in a tub of boiling water and scrub the heck out of. Anything that's colored with dye is going to not withstand the abuse that these kids are going to put their dresses through and the cleaning process that would need to undergo. So infants were dressed in long gowns that typically had a drawstring back, and the bottom of it would be folded up over the baby's feet to keep it warm. And they would be dressed in long clothes until they were about 9 months old to a year, basically until they became mobile. When children became around a year old, or once they started walking, they would go into smaller dresses, shorter dresses that would let them move their legs unencumbered. But again, both boys and girls wore dresses up until about the age of somewhere between 3 and 7. At around the age 3 to 7, gender distinctions appear in children's clothing. Going into pants was considered a milestone in a little boy's life. It was called breeching. So he generally went into short pants somewhere between the age of 3 and 7, and he would stay in short pants until around the age of 12, in which time he would go into long pants, which would be another milestone in his life. Little girls would wear dresses that tended to close in the back, and often with little pantalettes underneath. And this is kind of a distinct kid look, and she would continue that until she was around 10 or 12. And at that point, at age 10 or 12, a little girl's outfit is going to generally mimic that of her mother's. Children at that age were dressed basically as little miniature adults. The one distinction being that girls wore shorter skirts. A girl's skirts would start maybe around her knee, and then they would gradually lengthen. And then her sign of reaching maturity is when she would wear full-length skirts. And this would happen maybe around the age of 14 or so. Now we're going to contrast older and younger women's dresses and pay special attention to the older woman's dress, because there are a lot of conventions of this dress that you see echoed in Lucy McWhirter's reproduction dress. So older women, and I'm going to quote here from an etiquette manual of 1854, it says, "Neither will an elderly lady attire herself in gaudy colors, nor wear a profusion of ornaments, nor affect habiliments which become young people. To do so in advanced years will militate against that respect and deference which it demands, and assuredly subject the ancient to contempt and ridicule." Which is to say that older ladies should wear dark muted colors and not bright colors. That was the kind of middle class advice of the day. older ladies also had the option of going without a corset or perhaps wearing her corset loose. The corset was the basic foundational garment of all 19th century underwear. It kind of serves the function of a bra today. It would help to support the back and breasts of the wearer and also provide a foundation for the dresses going over it. Until you get older, in which case it becomes optional because then you've apparently earned the right to let loose and not constrict your torso anymore. So you can see that the dress, the waist on the brown dress is a lot looser and the color is muted. The dress on the right, the blue dress, is a young woman's dress. And we can tell this because it's got a wide neckline that's characteristic of younger women's clothes, because it's got the very fitted waist, and because of its vibrant blue color. And there's a different etiquette manual from 1870 that says, a certain gaiety and brightness of attire is as suitable for youth as sober colors and quiet styles are for the more advanced in life. We'll move on to the morning dress. So the 19th century was a century in which death was an everyday part of life. For much of the 19th century, child mortality hovered around 30%. That is to say, 3 out of every 10 children born would not live to see their 20th birthdays. Death was just ever present. No vaccines, no antibiotics. And death tended to be an at-home affair. People would grow ill and they would die in their own homes. And the family, usually the women, would take care of the body and prepare it for burial in the home. And the funerals would take place in the home. And so this great culture of mourning developed in the 19th century. And most of that mourning expression fell to women. So men's mourning conventions generally were to wear a black band around a hat or an arm for perhaps 3 to 6 months if his wife died. And the underlying reason being that he had generally work to go to, so he had to kind of dress the part of a businessman. And if this was a widower with small children at home, he was expected to find another wife to help take care of his house and rear his children fairly quickly. Women, on the other hand, had a very complicated mourning ritual. There were prescriptions of what kind of black dress should be worn for how long. The most extreme example is for a woman whose husband has died. So a widow was expected to wear deepest black for about 6 months to a year. This means all black, no jewelry, nothing shiny, just matte, matte, matte. For the next 6 months to a year, she was allowed to wear second mourning, which was still black, but probably, you know, like jet jewelry or a little bit of zhuzh to it. So the mourning dress we're looking at now would be considered a second mourning dress. And then finally going into half mourning for another 6 months, and this would be a gray or a lavender color dress. So this could be upwards of 2.5 years of mourning someone's husband. And of course, this is the ideal. This is like, you know, the Martha Stewart version of mourning. How people actually implemented this in their lives depended on a variety of factors. It depended on the woman's personal inclination, if she wanted to do that. It depended on her financial means, if she could afford to wear nothing but black clothes for 2.5 years, on her social standing. But suffice to say, the practice of mourning was widespread. This dress here dates to 1894, and it was worn by Clara Mason Hoffaker, and she wore this in mourning of her father when he died. And for a parent, the etiquette manuals of the day suggested a mourning period of about 6 months. Oops. And then there's a burial dress. So remember I said that in the early part of the 19th century, death took place at home. And the body was washed and dressed and laid out at home. So in the beginning part of the 19th century, this meant that people tended to be buried in the clothes they wore from life. And it generally fell into one of two categories. People were either dressed in their night clothes, and this kind of represented the idea that death was equivalent to a long sleep, so they're dressed for bed. Or people might be dressed in their nice traveling clothes, and this suggested the idea that death is a journey that they were undertaking. After the Civil War, by the end of the 19th century, the business of dying moved out of the home and literally did become a business. Funerals in funeral parlors took the place of funerals in the home parlor. And now there are professional undertakers who came and whisked the body away and embalmed it and prepared it for burial. And so the burial dress you're looking at now is a product that would have been sold by a professional undertaker. And it was, this one was intended for a young girl. And the part that you're looking at is finished nicely. So the part that would be visible in the top half of a casket has the pleats and the ruffles and the nice details. The rest of the dress is basically like a paper bag. It's got rough edges, it's got unfinished seams, it's scratchy, and you know, this is because it's purely meant for show and only for show for the about the waist up. Okay, so now the thing that we've all been waiting for. Thank you, New Philadelphia Association, for your patience. And now let's dive into Lucy McWhirter's dress. And so I'm sure that most of you probably know about the McWhirter history than I do. So please forgive me if I'm repeating anything that you already know or skipping over pieces of information that you know well that I didn't turn over. But I just wanted to contextualize Lucy's life a little bit. And from what I was able to discover, not much is known about Lucy in her younger years. I gather that she was born in 1771 and she married Frank in Pulaski County, Kentucky in 1799. And the interim is kind of a question mark. I did find that her maiden name was Denham, and that there are two families of Denhams living in Pulaski County, Kentucky in the year 1800 in the census. One of them originated in North Carolina and the other originated in Virginia. So I would say it seems likely that perhaps Lucy belonged to one of those two families and was born either in Virginia or North Carolina and was taken to Kentucky at some point in the late 18th century. So this gives us a little bit of context about what Lucy might have worn as a young woman. Enslaved children in Virginia tended to be dressed very simply. Whether they were boys or girls, they tended to be dressed in a shift or a shirt that is just kind of a basic, simple construction there. And then as enslaved girls grew older, and I'm going based off Virginia research because it's more extensive than that into the research of the clothing of enslaved people in Kentucky, which is the research on the early history of slavery in Kentucky is kind of spotty. But here we have a watercolor by Benjamin Henry Latrobe. And it shows two enslaved women working in a field in Virginia in 1798. And this jives with what the scholarship seems to indicate about the clothing of enslaved women, that clothing was given in a yearly allotment, and a standard allotment included a petticoat, shifts, a jacket, a pair of stockings, and a pair of shoes. So the jacket is that short little bodice that she's wearing, and the petticoat is the skirt. And so this seems probably typical of what Lucy might have worn as a young enslaved woman. She had agency in her clothes, not in what she was given to wear, but in little ways that she would have been able to personalize her attire. So if Lucy was making her own clothes, which seems likely, especially if she was living in Kentucky, she might have had agency in dyeing the fabric or in weaving certain colors of clothing together. I should say as an aside that slavery in Kentucky in the early years wasn't like the big cotton plantations with lots of enslaved people on it. Typically there were a handful of enslaved people, maybe no more than four, and tended to be farms growing hemp or wheat or oats or barley. So on such a small operation, we can maybe infer that Lucy would have had a direct hand in making her clothes and either been given an allotment of cloth, which tended to be of an inferior grade for enslaved people, or because she was a young woman during the Revolutionary War when America was boycotting imported British textiles, that Lucy might have indeed been weaving some of her own cloth. So again, she might have chosen the colors to weave or the colors to combine. Scholarship also suggests that enslaved women had agency over their attire in the ways that they put ensembles together. Combining, perhaps a gift of a clothing or a cast-off item of clothing from the mistress of the house, combining it with a different skirt, putting together the garments that she did have to express her individuality. There's also considerable research that enslaved women tended to favor bright colors and patterns, and this is a direct link to the African textile traditions where bright colors and patterns were favored and seen as a sign of distinction. And so there are instances where white 19th century Americans remark on the brightness of the colors of enslaved people, or on the way that enslaved people have patched their clothes in such a way that it almost looks like a quilt, a patchwork of patches. And this is represents the enslaved woman's kind of ties to cultural heritage and creation of a clothing system and a cultural set of values that are not understood by white America, but are important and meaningful to the enslaved community. And this all becomes important when we consider Lucy in, my best guess is this is about the late 1850s, perhaps 1860. And now Lucy is a free land-owning woman. She and Frank moved to Illinois in 1831, and Frank was able to amass a considerable amount of land. You all know that he also was able to purchase the freedom of several family members and left money in his estate to emancipate several more. So Lucy, by the time this photo is taken, is in her 80s. She is a free, very well-off woman. And so she has chosen to portray herself in the conventions of kind of middle-class society. She is wearing exactly what a refined older middle-class lady would wear. She's wearing the dark colors. She's chosen muted colors that the etiquette manuals prescribe. Her day cap is a kind of a nice little accessory. It was considered an elegant touch for older women. And you can see that she's got kind of the loose fan front bodice that indicates she's either wearing a corset loosely or that she's foregone it altogether, but both were entirely appropriate stylistic choices. So again, now we've got Lucy in her 80s, a free landowning woman in Illinois, and she is every inch the refined middle-class woman who, would pass muster with any etiquette manual of the time. This is the end of the presentation. Before I open it up to general questions, I do have one question that came in, and it's regarding these photographs of two gentlemen and asking if I could tell anything about them by their clothes. And I have to start with a caveat that men are harder than women. You know, women's clothing is very dateable and distinctive, and men, you know, they're kind of just all wearing suits. And men aren't my forte, but taking a stab at it, I would say that the man on the left in the stripy tie, this photograph dates to about the 1870s. And I'm sorry, I've got a shot. And the original question was, could either of these be Frank McWhirter? Okay, so the one on the left, no, because again, I would say this dates to the 1870s. This is a middle-class gentleman. He's not the wealthiest dude in the world, just because the material of his suit looks a little bit coarse. It's not the finest quality, probably wool in the world. However, between his tie, between his starched collar and white shirt front, his vest and his coat, he's prosperous and he is solidly middle class. The gentleman on the right is a maybe. I would say his tie kind of suggests to me that it might be 1860s, but again, I'm no expert on men's ties, so I wouldn't, you know, you can't take that to the bank. But this gentleman looks like, again, he's a prosperous middle-class gentleman, and he's got all the hallmarks. The starched white shirt collar, the tie, the vest, and especially the prominent watch fob there all indicate that this is a prosperous man. The photo might have been taken in the 1850s to 1860s, probably not any earlier than 1850. So I would say maybe this is Frank, and leave you with that.
Thank you so much for this wonderful presentation. I'm going to help you with the questions.
Awesome, thank you.
I wonder if you could start by, you've given us many different pictures. What is the actual collection in museums of these dresses and so on that exist in Illinois and around the country? I mean, how much do we have from the past?
We collectively, or we as the Illinois State Museum?
Well, start with the latter and go to the former.
Okay, so as the Illinois State Museum, we actually have this phenomenal collection of historic clothing that has never been seen before. So doing this show is an exciting way to put it out in front of people. We absorbed collections from both Illinois State University and the University of Illinois, it came from the home ec department. So they were garments that people were sort of studying to learn construction of historic clothing. We as a country, there are some amazing holdings of clothing. Kent State University has a phenomenal costume collection. The Metropolitan Museum of Art has a phenomenal costume collection. There are pockets out there. I do want to say that one glaring gap in museum collections across the country is that of the clothing of African Americans. And I actually wrote a blog post about Lucy's dress, and I tried to go into it a little bit there. There are two primary reasons for this. The first is that the clothing that survives tends to be that was owned by middle class to affluent people. And so if you think of the amount of clothing that survives, it's a tiny proportion of what was actually out there in the world being worn. And that tiny proportion belonged to a fairly small segment of the population. The middle class and the prosperous class was in the minority of people generally. And then people of color are a minority of that minority. On the one hand, because of simple numbers, and on the other hand, because of Jim Crow kept a lot of people from advancing economically. So there's a smaller pool that survives to draw from. And then frankly, there's institutional bias and racism in museums. Museums founded by white people, run by white people, taking donations from white people who had kind of white blinders on and, you know, didn't think to build the collections of African American clothing. So that's why we reproduced Lucy's dress instead of, you know, using an example, a surviving example, because we couldn't put our hands on one because it's so rare. So this is something that we are very cognizant of in the museum and working hard to correct. We hope that we can start building up our collection of African-American textiles to fill that gap.
We know that in food, for example, in county fairs, you know, people would have competition, who could make the best pie. And we know that later there were fashion shows and runways of various houses of producing garments. Have there been competitions in the past to determine prizes for the best dressmakers?
I don't know about dressmakers, but certainly sewing and needlework. So the state fairs would have, you know, the prize-winning quilts, the best pair of socks, the best man's shirt. So certainly there was that competitive aspect and avenue for women to display their handiwork.
There's a question from Vicky. I collect antique photos and have a text on style with illustrations from the 1840s through 1890s. However, it is British. Can you recommend a good source for a book on American style?
Yes. So one book that I lean very heavily on is called Dressed for the Photographer, and it's by Jane Severa, S-E-V-E-R-A. And it goes through photographs of people from the 1840s to the 1890s. And she, I mean, that woman can read a photograph like no one's business. And she really does a deep dive on, you know, this woman is wearing a wool dress with pleats and it means this. And she's probably, you know, this class and this time of day. And so a really extraordinary resource.
When did women start wearing pants? You know, like, in other words, if they were on a farm and the husband died and she had to go out and deal with the chickens and the cows and the pigs and the corn, would she wear a dress or would she put on pants?
Sure, that's a great question. And so there's no black and white answer. There's when women started wearing pants, and then there's when it became socially acceptable to wear pants. So the first women to put on bloomers were dress reformers of the 1850s, and they were kind of making a statement, you know, they're advocating for women's liberation and more liberation in women's clothing. Those kind of people considered them fringe, you know. They were on the right side of history, but it didn't go over super well among the popular crowd in the 1850s. You're exactly right that farm folk, women would wear pants. And in that Dress for the Photographer book, there are a couple of really neat examples of women on farms, and especially during the later 19th century, women on the plains of Nebraska. And they're kind of modified bloomer outfits. They're not straight up pants, but they're like, you know, a knee length skirt with pants underneath. But you're right, it's a lot more practical to do your work, especially outside or in the winter, in pants than, you know, in a heavy dress. But in terms of when it became socially acceptable, probably not until the 1930s or 40s. So a long way to go.
An aspect of that is today, of course, we're dealing with the LGBTQ. And so I wonder if women who were gay in that period of time would break convention and dress like a man. Was that ever in the literature?
That's an excellent question as well. And so one photograph we feature in the exhibit is of a woman named Jenny, and I forgot her surname, but she signed up in the Civil War and fought as Albert Fisher. So she presented herself as a man to fight, but at the close of the Civil War, she continued to dress as a man and live as a man. So it's unclear, you know, she didn't spell out her intentions. It might have been that she wanted to continue enjoying the privileges that 19th century society gave to men versus women, like voting. And it could be also that she identified as a man and she was dressing to match her identity. So yes, especially in terms of serving in wartime, there are instances of women dressing as men, and there are isolated incidents, and it's hard to tell because no one really came out and said exactly how they identified, or maybe didn't have the language even to articulate mm-hmm. how they identified. So there's a lot of guesswork, but there is photographic evidence, yes, of women dressing as men.
Today, when we, each of us who are attending this, look in our closets, we see many shirts, many pants, many pairs of shoes. I'm not sure we have as many as Imelda Marcos had, how many garments did the typical working class and middle class people have as options for their own wearing?
So the short answer is a lot less than us. And a working class woman might have two dresses. She might have her everyday dress and she might have her Sunday dress. A middle class woman might have, I don't know, half a dozen dresses, 10 maybe. Women would wear chemises underneath, which is kind of like, it's like a short sleeve nightgown, and this is what you wear close to your body, and this is what absorbs the sweat and oil and dirt, and this is what gets clean. So a woman might have, you know, even a working class or a woman of limited means might have 6 chemises that she cycled through, but 2 dresses. Chemises being linen or cotton were also less expensive too, and less involved to make. But in terms of actual clothing, you know, a really nice wardrobe would probably have 10 to 12 dresses in it. And we know kind of prosperous women like Mary Lincoln. Mary Lincoln talks about having a new dress for the season, you know, so getting a new dress once a year was kind of, you know, a big thing.
I'd like to add a footnote to what you mentioned earlier about Eli Whitney and cotton gin. He was a member of the social elite and graduated from Yale in 1792. The next year, he comes up with the cotton gin. And it's been reflected that he, in fact, interviewed slaves who were actually working in cotton. He didn't know anything about cotton. He moved from New England to the South. And shortly after that, he invented the cotton gin. And that sort of parallels today when my father, for example, Festus McWhorter, worked in the steel mill, and there was a suggestion box. And he made many suggestions as to how to improve the process, and he got a thank you note for that. So that the slaves who helped Eli Whitney create this, we don't know anything about them, but right. We do know about Eli Whitney.
Yes, yeah, you're exactly right. I had heard that he came from the North and, you know, didn't know anything about cotton or making cotton, but you're right, he's the one that we remember today and credit with this invention that, yeah, was someone else's work.
Now, when it comes to the transition from the handmade clothing in the house and the factory system, how did that play out in the terms of the North and the South? Because it seems that what we learn generally from history is that cotton was produced in the South, but the industrial development of the textile mills, that was in the North.
Right. So in terms of textile production, I think across the country, people had access to these factory-produced textiles in North and South, and really changed people's habits. People usually used linen as undergarments and as sheeting and household textiles, and they switched to cotton because cotton was cheaper, you know, it's being mass-produced. During the Civil War, the less industrial South, who was also losing the war, had less access to these factory-made textiles. And so they experienced, you know, having to pull out their spinning wheels and relearn home weaving and home sewing, whereas the supply chain in the North was still going strong. And in fact, in Northern women's clothing, you don't really see any signs of hardship. They're still wearing their big hoop skirt dresses and going on pretty happily. After the Civil War was over in the 19th century, it was the factories boomed. And so again, you've got textile mills. Now you have woolen mills cranking out wool in the United States. And this happened because cotton was hard to come by and cotton was being boycotted during the Civil War. So they switched to wool to close the soldiers. So American woolen mills are getting up and going. Americans finally figure out how to mass produce silk as well. So there's all these American mills, and that really drives down the prices of textiles and makes them accessible. Certainly North and the South, I would say, once they, you know, kind of got themselves on firmer economic footing after losing the war, women of the South, you know, were buying factory produced textiles as well.
What about buttons? The production of buttons.
A little bit fuzzy on them. I know they were made from mussel shells that come out of the Illinois River. And I'm not sure when this gets going. I know it dies out around the 19-teens, but for a good portion of the late 19th century, mussels are being harvested like nobody's business to create mother-of-pearl buttons. There were wool buttons, wood buttons, bone buttons. For a period in the, around the 1880s, there are these beautiful artistic buttons, and I don't know where they're being made, but on our dresses from that time period, they're like little miniature works of art. So there's kind of a big variety.
There's another question. Was homespun common in Illinois, and when did it die out?
That is a great question. So homespun was very common, based on what I'm seeing in my own collection, among rural dwellers, which is actually most of Illinois during the 19th century. So if you lived in town, you were more likely to purchase your clothing, because clothing, factory-made textiles were pretty widely available. England had hit the Industrial Revolution about a century before America, and England was cranking out all kinds of factory-made fabrics at a cheap enough rate that they could be purchased in Illinois, relatively affordably. But we do see that rural families are coming, and they are typically making their own linen. Linen and wool are the two fabrics that can generally be made from home, and it seems like more Illinoisans are making linen. And I've actually got a little linen making display in the exhibition, so I hope you'll come see that. And what happens is, so people are making homespun linen in the first half of the 19th century. And then as cotton production increases, it actually kind of causes homespun to die out, because linen production is inexpensive, but it's super labor intensive. And cotton reaches a point where it's cheap enough that it just makes more sense for people to buy cotton than to make their own. And there's this little like overlap period where women are spinning their own linen thread or weaving their own linen cloth, and they're actually taking it to the general store and they're bartering their homespun linen for factory produced cloth.
What about design? For example, today, obviously, there are all kinds of magazines and people look at fashion. How did people in the 19th century become aware of fashion styles and innovations and changes?
Fashion magazines were definitely a thing in the 19th century, too. So Paris was kind of the fashion capital of the world at that point, and there were these illustrated French fashion magazines, and East Coast publishers would get their hands on them, and they would copy them more or less directly. So they'd copy these fashion plates and reprint them in Peterson's magazine or Godey's ladies book, and this would be sent out all over America, you know, all social classes, rural and urban. And what these fashion magazines was a guide. It didn't come with patterns. It came with a written description of how to sew something. And you're meant to either use it as inspiration to kind of make something or remake something, or take it to your dressmaker and she can help you figure out how to do it. By the 1860s, we have the rise of commercial dress patterns. And so this puts fashion in the hands of people, makes it a little more accessible. In the beginning, dress patterns were just a template. It wasn't fitted to any kind of size. You would take it and then you would cut it, you know, and fit it to each individual person. By about the 1880s, dress patterns were sized. So you could take something, you know, purchase this pattern, and anyone who had the skills to make it or could hire someone to make it could be dressed in, you know, the latest Parisian fashions.
We do have a question about Lucy, but we know that's the only picture we have of her. So we really don't have any information about how she was dressed otherwise, other than your generalizations about what women like her were wearing. But another question is, how much would a typical ball gown cost versus a working class woman's typical work dress? What, in other words, what are the kind of price differences for the different types of dresses that you showed us?
It's really kind of hard to untangle what 19th century things cost, and I've had trouble there. Suffice to say that I've caught references of, you know, Mary Lincoln, sorry, I'm in Springfield, everything comes back to Mary Lincoln because she's so well documented. But, you know, she was known to spend like $50 to $100 on a dress, which to me seems insane because I don't spend $100 on a dress in 2020, you know? So in the 1860s, if you had the means, I think you could really buy crazy expensive clothes. Whereas, cotton dress, you could probably buy cotton for, you know, 30 cents a yard plus material. So you could get yourself a nice dress for, you know, $2-3. A serviceable cotton dress. So there's a huge disparity.
When you mentioned sewing machines, two questions about that. One is Singer tends to be the sort of brand name of sewing machines. Is that what started in the 1850s?
And that's what is the relationship? And I know, I think there was a man named Elias Howe who patented one in the 1840s. So yes, I'm sorry, I was giving all the credit to Singer, but I think he was the first one to kind of get them going and get a system going to produce them. The first true patent happened in the 1840s.
What about the mass production of thread?
That I'm a little fuzzier on. I think that happened fairly early on. So the textile mills in Lowell, I think, were creating yarn before they were creating fabric, and then people would weave the yarn themselves. And so I'm guessing that thread happened earlier, probably in the early part of the 19th century, but I don't know for sure, so don't quote me on that.
You certainly can't have a sewing machine without thread.
For sure, yes. This is an excellent point, right?
Yeah. Now, here's another question. You said that the knowledge of sewing was a gender-specific skill that all women were expected to have, like cooking, preparing food. When I was in elementary school in the 1940s, all the boys had to take a class in sewing, and all the girls had to take a class in shop.
Ha! That's awesome. Yes, and I maybe lean too heavily on it being completely gendered. I would say that all women and girls were expected to know how to sew, but not necessarily that no men did. Certainly, I think many men had basic mending skills, you know, bachelors living on their own, and oftentimes soldiers in the field, you know, they could put a button on or, you know, stitch up a hem or patch something. So, and certainly tailors were very skilled sewers at the time too.
That was going to be a related question, because being a tailor was a highly skilled, you think of that as a highly skilled craft that serviced people with money, because you'd go to a tailor to have something done. Even today, that's what goes on.
Yes, absolutely. So tailors were highly skilled, and that was a gendered profession. Tailors were men, and men made clothes for men. So it was in kind of a gender hierarchy sort of way that it was considered kind of, you know, at the top of the sewing profession. And women tended to work for tailors. They might do seaming and make buttonholes and things like that. But with these merchant tailors or tailor shops, it was the man, the tailor, was kind of the master sewer of the shop.
I have kind of a strange question to ask you. Based on what you've taught us about clothing, how would you hope when we open our closet door, we would think differently about clothing that we have and that we might buy?
I guess, you know, some of the questions I put to you in the talk are ones that I never considered until I started working on this exhibition. But I guess I would, again, invite all of you to ask, to think about, where did your clothes come from and who made them and under what conditions? And then another question too is, where do your clothes go when you're done with them? Mm. You know, we have such a disposable society, and in the 19th century, you didn't throw things away. You know, once a garment was past its useful life, then you made it over for a child or someone smaller than you, or you cut strips for a quilt or a rag rug or something. You know, things just didn't go away. But now it's like, you know, when you're done with your clothes, what do you do with them? Maybe many of us donate them, but where do those clothes wind up, you know? And I think a lot of it is, you know, clothes literally get thrown away today that never would have happened a century ago.
Well, my aunt, who grew up in New Philadelphia, she was still turning shirt collars.
Oh, like cutting them off and slipping them?
Exactly. And when I was in school, in elementary school, we were learning how to darn socks. You know, because, you know, you get a hole in your sock and then you had to patch it up.
Sure, right.
But that's not what happens today.
No, you go to Target and buy another 10-pack of socks today. But, you know, that, how did we get to that point, right? Like, that's not conservation-minded at all.
What about the Native Americans? What kind of interaction? We know that Europe, you said Paris was the style center for the Western world. But people who lived in the frontier were living close to Native Americans that had their own approach to clothing. Was there any interaction?
There was. This is a great question. And actually, our curator of anthropology contributed a facet to the exhibition on Native American clothes. So Native peoples came into contact with Euro-Americans early on in the 1600s. And so there's a practice of, in some ways, Native people assimilated like fabrics into their clothes making practices, because the fabric was easier to work with than hide, or, you know, glass beads are easier to work with than making quills by hand. So there is a sort of modification of Euro patterns. And then during the 19th century, the Native American people were removed from Illinois by the 1830s. And so that tradition disappears off our landscape. In general, there becomes this trend of sort of forced cultural assimilation, where Native people are sort of impelled to wear Euro-American clothes, and sometimes Native children are actually put into American schools where they're socialized to, you know, dress American, speak English, kind of divest them of their heritage. And ironically, at the same time this is going on, there becomes this sort of American fascination with Native style. So you get tourists going to places like the Ho-Chunk Reservation in Wisconsin and purchasing beaded items, which they see as kind of a tourist novelty, sort of appreciating as passive consumers this Native style that, on the other hand, the American culture is trying to stamp out simultaneously.
Yeah. Well, you're such a fountain of knowledge. It's really wonderful to talk to you and to create such an appetite for us to see the exhibit.
I hope so. Yes, it will be soon. If I can hint broadly that the opening date is coming, and I hope everyone will come pay us a visit.
Well, I'd like to ask Marinelle if she would unmute and join the video to make a ad for our next webinar.
Okay, and right before that, I wanted to add to your, Erica was talking about clothing being reused and passed down. And in the Berry Museum here, we obtained a wedding quilt a few years ago that was, as near as we can tell, it was made by neighbors. It wasn't made by anybody in the family, but it was a wedding quilt, but it was made out of old shirts and dresses of the neighbor who made the quilt. And then they gave it for a wedding present in maybe 1870s, in that range. And so we have, and it's made out of Lindsay Woolsey. So if anybody's in the area, when you go to the local museum, there's a really good example of this clothing being used over and over again. And also, Berry had their own woolen mill for quite a few years, so.
That's awesome. And if I had known that, I would have asked to borrow that quilt for my exhibit. So that is a treasure.
Yeah.
Well, everybody that goes to the exhibit in Springfield can come on over to Berry and go to the Berry Museum.
That's true.
Okay. So what did you want me to do, Gerald?
Give an ad for the next webinar.
Okay. Our final Likes series lecture for next week is going to be Bill Camphouse, and he is going to educate us on music of the mid-1800s and on down to early 1900s, and he will use some of the Pike Piper's music that I think probably has already been recorded as part of his lecture. But it sounds like it will be a very interesting and pleasant presentation. And, oh yes, and my husband is reminding me that one of the pieces is one of the three pieces that Hermes Zimmerman, who grew up out at New Philadelphia and was a musician and wrote music and did published out of that area. One of his pieces has been recorded, and that will be part of the presentation.
Thank you so much, Marinelle, and I hope that everyone who's here will come next week as well. And I just want to say the outstanding character of tonight's presentation makes me think that people often misunderstand this country. They think that both coasts are where everything is happening. And tonight we got a glimpse of the treasures, the cultural treasures that exist in the heart of this country. And I'm talking about the state of Illinois. And if you look at the last slide here, we are, like most other local organizations, trying to raise money to accomplish what we're trying to do. And New Philadelphia is in the midst of a land acquisition campaign. So we can secure the land of New Philadelphia and make it something that's part of the national cultural heritage from now on. And we have a person who's willing to match any dollar you contribute. So if you contribute a dollar, that will be doubled. $10 would be 20, $100 would be 200, and I could keep going. So thank you so much. Again, Erica, you have our digital applause for a marvelous presentation. And we'll welcome everybody back next week.
And good night to everybody. Thank you for being here.
Okay.
Thanks so much.
Bye-bye. Most
fun. Excellent job. Wonderful. And I hope you can see in the chat, you're getting lots of praise and appreciation.
Thanks for bearing with my beta testing this whole Zoom talk thing. I hope it went okay.
I thought it went well.
Well, thank you. It's disconcerting not being able to see anybody's reaction. You know, it's like, is this landing? Am I, you know, are people hating this?
I felt the same way last week in not knowing. Now I figured out with help that I can see who was actually out there, the names anyway. But last week it was like, I didn't even know who was out there. And it's like, you know, what's going on? But you did a great job.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that.
This recording is going to be up online too, so I'll be sure and send out the link, and more people will enjoy it that weren't able to come to the talk.
Great. That's wonderful. Thank you.
So, all right. We'll go and enjoy the rest of your evening, Erica and everybody else.
Thanks so much. Appreciate it. Come see the show when it opens.
Definitely.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye.
It was a great presentation. I really enjoyed it, the clothing.
Wasn't it great? I couldn't agree more. Wow. I mean, it really it made me think about my own clothes and the whole world of fashion versus clothes. And lots of thoughts. Very thought-provoking.
Yes, I have some of my little kid clothes that my mother had sewn for me in a drawer somewhere. Wow. And I did start making doll clothes when I was probably 5, and I started sewing on the sewing machine before I started school, I think. I really liked to sew.
You know, you could do
now, talking about what people did with their clothes. Now, a lot of times when people die, particularly like a father, they'll take his shirts and maybe make bears for the rest of the family, or use his shirts in making quilts, or his clothes in a quilt or something, and give to the rest of the family. They are remembering people.